We live in a fantasy world now. Reality has been destroyed.
This is the time that we really need to pay attention.
The probabilities are overwhelmingly on gold's side.
That is the best environment to see gold increase its value.
Welcome to Palisades Gold Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodrovic. Joining me today is Lawrence Lepard from EMA2.com Equity Management Associates. How are you today, Larry?
I'm great. Thanks, Tom. Very nice to be back on your show.
It's always great to have you. So, Larry, you and I were tagged in a news story last week about Uganda finding something like 32,000 tons of gold worth somewhere in the neighborhood of 12 trillion US dollars. So the article says there's a total of 2 trillion US dollars in existence. So, you know, that was one of the first clues to me that something was up with the article. So after a quick Google search, that's the number of physical notes in existence. But since the story is making the rounds, I wanted to get your take on it and
shed some light on it. Yeah, we don't spend a lot of time. This story, I don't know who wrote this. I don't know what they were thinking or doing, but this thing is such complete and utter bullshit. I mean, let's just put it in context. Okay, let's just kind of do the big picture numbers. Mm-hmm. There are between 190,000 and 200,000 tons of gold above ground. This is metric tons, T-O-N-N-E-S.
Refined gold,
right? Jewelry, central banks, bullion, coins, all this stuff. Okay, antiquities. All right, and they're claiming they found 31,000 tons, which would add 15% to the supply. So first, the notion that, they're going to double the amount of gold in the world. I saw somebody commenting on it. That's not true. Even if they were correct in that 31,000, it's a 15% add. But let's just talk about how incorrect they are in their 31,000. So the fact of the matter is that, as you and I know, that we've been exploring for gold for hundreds of years. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of mines that have been worked over the years around the world, and we've been looking for deposits. And the world's been pretty well picked over. Okay, and today, if you find gold, you're lucky to find 1 million ounces. And if you find 1 million, you hope it grows into 5 or maybe 10 million ounces. So, mm-hmm. 5 or 10 million ounces would be a big deposit. And there occasionally you find deposits that over time, they grow to become, 20, 30, 40, but that takes years. And even the 1 million to 10 can take a couple of years to drill it out. And so that you know that you really have it. And 10 certainly takes more than a couple of years. 1 million can take a couple of years to drill it out. So let's just put that in context. What's 1 million ounces? Divided by tons. One ton is 32,150 troy ounces. So a 1 million ounce deposit is 31 tons, 31. Mm-hmm. A 10 million ounce deposit is 311 tons. They're claiming they found 31,000 tons. That is beyond absurd. They're claiming they just found something that is, orders of magnitude larger than the largest mines we've ever found. The possibility that they've done that is zero. They've no doubt, they probably have found some gold, mm-hmm. and maybe it turns into a pretty good mine. Maybe they found 10 tons. Maybe they found 20 or 30 tons. The point is that there's no way they found 31,000 tons. Mm-hmm. And so it's really just kind of a bullshit story, but it got everybody all lathered up that, the gold supply is going to increase, and therefore, we're going to have, inflation and so on and so forth. So it's really not worth paying a lot of attention to. And it's pretty easy to debunk it. Mm-hmm. And the fact that it got out there on the mainstream press, I was kind of surprised.
And just looking at it from another number aspect to it is, let's say, the average grade. It would be something 100 times the average grade.
Yeah, right? That's another thing they said. They took, I don't have the article in front of me, but they took the number of square meters and they said, we've got this many ounces and this many square meters. And somebody did the math and said that would imply that there was 320 some odd thousand or 320 grams per ton of ore that they were mining. Okay. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about how absurd that is. That's almost solid gold. A ton isn't that large. The highest grade mines in the world today are lucky if they achieve 30 grams per ton in production. And that's when they're mining really rich seams of gold. West Dome and some others have been at 30 at times, and they can't even average that with dilution. But mm-hmm. And these guys are claiming that what they found, the dirt they found that they say is so mineral rich, has got 330, again, an order of magnitude higher than the largest mines that are being mined today. The richest mines are being mined. Mm-hmm. It's just absurd. It's just completely and totally absurd. It's a fabrication. Again, I don't know who or why they did it. You know, what you know, somebody in Uganda, probably, you know, I have no idea why it happened, but it's just so wrong. I just saw it. I looked at it. I quickly surveyed it, ran the numbers. This is just a joke. There's no way this is true. Mm-hmm. Absolutely no way. So, mm-hmm. And I think everybody in the mining industry, you know, who knows anything about the math, the mining, knows that came to the same conclusion. The problem is people who don't understand the business, don't understand the mining, don't understand how it all works. You know, like, oh, wow, look at this. You know, tons of supply coming out. Price of gold's going to go down. No, that's not how it works. It's just wrong.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's why I wanted to bring it up with you to, you know, shed a little bit of light on it and get your perspective on it.
Yeah.
So, you know, last time we spoke, Larry, we touched on the dollar and how the process of the world, you know, moving away from the dollar to another reserve currency has started. So with the recent dollar strength, does this continue to add pressure to the rest of the world to find ways around it?
Yeah, it does. I mean, boy, you've opened up the can of worms that I call, you know, the big macro picture. And ever since I started, I pivoted my fund to be only gold and silver miners in 2008. And back then, I remember I coined the term monetary chaos. And I feel like, Tom, we're living in a world of monetary chaos. I mean, it's like, oh, dear God, you know. You know, as we all know, we built an enormous debt structure and we've lived in a world of very easy money for a long time, you know, most particularly post 2008, when they kept interest rates at the ZERP level from 08 to 15 before they did the first raise. That was 7 years of free money. Mm-hmm. And that created just enormous distortions. And headline inflation was very low. It didn't flow into goods and services, but financial asset inflation was quite substantial. And that continued and got worse. And I think that, you know, I'm going through all this just because I think it's important. If you look at today's point of where we are, I think you have to understand how we got there before you can kind of diagnose what does that mean for where we are today. So I'm just kind of trying to set the background. So we created this big, enormous bubble of overvalued financial assets based on very low and cheap underpriced capital. And this is what created, you know, the Cape Shiller, you know, PE ratios that were off the charts, and the stock market bubble that was off the charts, and the bond market bubble that was off the charts, and negative interest rates in Europe. I mean, things we could never imagine. We never imagined money could get this cheap. And we never, at least I never imagined that stocks and bonds could get this overvalued compared to their fundamental value. But they did. Okay. And I think what we're going to see, what's going to be important, what's going to be historic here is that I think the bubble, they peaked in 2022. I mean, some things peaked in 2021. I mean, the high-tech high flyers that were in, you know, Cathie Wood's ARK fund peaked earlier and started to crash. And that was the early warning indicator. It was like back in 2000 when some of the early dot-com things started to go south and you knew it was going to come for everything else. Well, that was the early indicator of what's going on now. And you know, and I'm just writing my quarterly letter for the second quarter. I mean, the first quarter, everything was down a bit. But it was pretty easy. I mean, it was, you know, S&P, NASDAQ, Dow were all kind of down high single digits. It was pretty easy to say, well, you know, maybe this is just another correction, a buy the dip kind of situation. And in fact, you know, what we learned this quarter is no, it wasn't. You know, the bubble found a pin, right? I mean, it definitely burst. And now everything's down 20% round numbers, NASDAQ's more. But everything's down 20%, you know, and we saw it in the crypto universe, all these fake cryptocurrencies blew up. And, you know, and so what we see is that the bubble, the cheap money, everything bubble just found a pin. And we always knew that the level of debt we created was risking one of two things, either, you know, extreme inflation or extreme deflation. And so, you know, debt is deflationary, right? When you borrow money to spend on things, you know, you get the things, but the debt remains. So you're bringing future consumption into the present time. And as a result of that, in the future, it means you got to pay back the debt. And so you're going to have less consumption at a future point in time. And so that problem became, you know, so the debt, the process of quote unquote paying back debt is very deflationary. Now, of course, my view is we can't pay back this debt. It's too large. It's out of control. But, you know, as we also know, the Federal Reserve in 2020 and 2021, you know, continued to practice QE. We had enormous stimulus. We had 40% growth in the money supply coming out of COVID. And as a result of all that, we've got enormous inflation. And of course, the Federal Reserve ignored it, said it was transitory, kept marching forward. And then finally, they woke up and said, oh, shit, we got a real inflation problem here. And a couple of days late and a couple of pennies short, they decided to slam on the brakes, right? Mm-hmm. And so what we saw in this quarter, most particularly, I mean, they started tapering the QE in the fall of, in late, you know, they signaled they were going to do it late 2020. They did it to some degree in late 2020. They stopped QE in March of this year. And now they've signaled heavily that they're going to enter QT, big QT, and that they're going to push up rates aggressively and for some time. And Powell is channeling his inner Paul Volcker and talking about how we got to get inflation under control. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you had this monetary system that was running wild and had all kinds of speculation, all kinds of blow off tops and everything, you know, based on free money and cheap money. And the Fed, too late, you know, a day late and a dollar short, realized they had a problem and they decided to come in and slam on the brakes. And that's what they've done. Mm-hmm. And so we've now got, and they basically said, we are going to get inflation under control. So they now have an enormous deflationary impulse taking place. And this is creating strength in the dollar and you know, it's creating deflation and everything else. As you can see, you know, oil prices are off, housing prices are getting soft, you know, all the leading indicators say we're going into a recession, even though the Fed denies that we're going into recession. And so just like they were late with slamming on the brakes, I mean, I think now they're going to be late to recognize that they've gone too far in the other direction and we're about to experience, I mean, if they don't change course or pivot, which is what we've all been talking about, we're going to experience something that looks very similar to the depression, to the 1929 to 1940 depression. And the reason is that you can't taper a Ponzi. You know, you cannot create a situation where you have high real interest rates when you have this much debt, because the economy is going to implode. We've already got U.S. I mean, Luke Roman pointed this out. We've already got U.S. tax receipts are down 15% in the month of May, year over year, right? And so, you know, the government's already running a big deficit, you know, call it $1.5 trillion pretty conservatively. Mm-hmm. You know, you're going to have increased social spending. You're going to have decreased tax income, you know, and the way I see it playing out is I think the market is going to continue to tank. I mean, when a bubble bursts historically, you don't just go down 20% and stop. When a bubble bursts, you go back to the base or you go down a lot. I mean, let's just take the last two bubbles, 2000, 2008. In both cases, the S&P 500 went down over 50% as a result of those bubbles bursting. And in the case of the 2001, the NASDAQ, the leading area, went down 80%. So, you know, and that's what you're seeing now. It affected the cryptos first. I mean, Bitcoin's down 75%. A lot of the junk cryptos are down more and have become worthless. Okay. And it hits everything. When you get a deflationary impulse, it absolutely hits everything because people scramble for cash. They say, oh my God, I'm over levered. I'm out over my skis. I paid too much for stuff. I've got obligations that I've got to meet. What am I going to sell? What, you know, and so money becomes more valuable. And of course, you know, the Fed had to do that because money was becoming less valuable at an extremely high rate, you know, last year. I mean, mm-hmm. Inflation, housing prices up year on year, 20%, you know, rents up year on year, 17%. I mean, these are absurd numbers. I mean, it reported inflation of 8.6 and the shadow government numbers even higher. So what we had, I mean, we're in one of those periods now where, as I said to you earlier, before we started the interview, we've got the dials, you know, the we're in the cockpit and all the instruments are starting to go berserk. You know what I mean? And we don't know what's up. It's almost like we don't know what's up. We don't know what's down. I mean, we're going crazy on inflation. And Powell's like, oh shit, got to solve that. You know, we're going to do it by tightening and okay, fine. I mean, he can continue on this path and the stock market's going to go to zero. Mm-hmm. I mean, and the bond market, you know, the bond market's going to, it'll probably rally strongly because people think the dollar is sound. Well, the bond market's going to be trickier, but the point is the stock market's going to go to zero and economic activity is going to go to zero. And the wealth effect is going to totally crater this economy. Ronnie Stoeferle had a great chart that he put up on Twitter that I retweeted a few days ago that showed that year to date in calendar 2022, Total stocks and bonds have lost $31 trillion worth of value. $31
trillion. Wow.
So, yeah, worldwide. But consider that in the context of the U.S. GDP is $21.5 trillion. So we've wiped out 1.5 times the U.S. GDP in paper wealth in the past 6 months. I mean, I don't know anybody who doesn't feel poorer today than they did in January. I mean, I don't know anybody. Me, it doesn't matter who you are. And surprisingly, and everyone who's in the gold space, like, oh my God, I'm getting killed. Well, yes and no. I mean, year to date, gold's down, what, 5-7%? I mean, everything's down. Everything else is down much worse. I mean, bonds are down more, stocks are down more, et cetera. So, you know, gold is actually hanging in there. I mean, it could continue to go down. I don't think it will. I think we're close to finding a base here for the next leg up. But, you know, what I think is going on is, I think Powell and these guys have realized they had an inflation problem, and they've done the only thing they know how to do, which is pretend they're Volcker. And yet today's world doesn't look like Volcker's world. When Volcker did what he did and he tamed inflation in the 79-80 period, you know, debt was 30% of GDP. U.S. debt, federal debt today is now 120% of GDP. So that's the other piece of the problem that occurs. When they do this, if they really manage to destroy demand and slow down the economy, you know, they're going to lose tax revenue. They're going to increase spending. And by pushing up interest rates the way they're doing it, you know, the government debt charges are going to be much larger. I mean, the government has got $30 trillion of debt that, you know, was running around $666 billion of interest charges last 12 months. You know, take interest rates up to 4%, say, which is what the Fed has mentioned, that that's a possible target. You know, 4% on $30 trillion, that's 1.2. There's another $600 billion added to the deficit. Mm-hmm. Oh, and by the way, you know, how do we finance the deficit? We finance it by selling debt. Oh, and by the way, who's buying the debt? You know, less people are buying the debt because, you know, the foreigners who used to buy the debt just saw us take $600 billion worth of Russian reserves and say, no, sorry, we can't let you have these. So, you know, China is less inclined to buy debt. India is less inclined to buy debt. You know, Saudi Arabia is less inclined to buy debt. Brazil and South America. So it's really a pretty big shit show, to be honest with you. And if you want to talk about how I see it, you know, unfolding, you know, I think it's interesting. I think the leading edge of the is money hard or is money soft question are gold and Bitcoin, right? I mean, they are non-state money substitutes, mm-hmm. right? Well, there's actually the three areas to watch: the dollar, gold, and Bitcoin. So if the dollar's going up and gold and Bitcoin are going down, money is hard. You know, they're trying to tame inflation, create deflation by raising interest rates and making the money sounder. That's fine. They're entitled to try to do that. The problem is the economy is going to blow up, you know. And in a related fashion, more importantly, when I don't think they understand, is the stock market's going to blow up, you know. And so, as I said before, when you have a bubble and it corrects 20%, which is what it's done, I think the next act is the next 30% is coming, and it's coming very soon. I believe that in July, August, September, the stock market's going to go down another. We're going to have another big leg down in the stock market. And at that point in time, you know, and unemployment's going to start to go up. And you're already seeing a little bit of that. Housing prices are going to continue to go down. We're seeing that because mortgage rates in the U.S. have doubled, and, you know, 30-year mortgage rates. And at that point in time, the Fed's going to realize they've got an entirely different problem, which is the economy's crumbling under their stricter, tighter monetary policy. Mm-hmm. And so they will pivot. And at that point in time, gold and Bitcoin are going to go to the moon. Mm-hmm. But in the interim, you know, we just got to sit around and take the pain. And that's, you know, and that's what we've been doing. And honestly, it's, you know, I've seen this so many times before. I've been through the cycle over and over again. It's just, it's like, okay, come on, here we go. You know, come on, Fed, wake up. You know, you're going to kill the economy. And And they know that. They do know that. They will pivot. They have to. They absolutely have to. What we don't know is when. I mean, I found it interesting that in his last press conference, Powell said he wanted to see a couple of months of increases in the headline CPI. And I'm sure one of the things they're watching very carefully is the price of oil.
Increasing or decreasing, Larry?
I'm sorry. Did I say increasing? I meant to say decreasing. Okay. I'm sorry. Decreasing. Yeah, in the CPI. And I'm sure that what they're watching, they're very carefully, they're watching the price of oil. As you saw, it was down big yesterday. It's down big again today. And, you know, and this is demand destruction, right? They want the economy. They want to cool off the economy. They want to get oil. Because if that happens, they will see a few months down probably in CPI prints. Mm-hmm. And then that'll allow them to cover, you know, I mean, the CPI could come back into
claim seven. Claim it as a victory.
Yeah, claim they've got it under control. Mm-hmm. And then they'll turn the taps back on again. And, you know, of course, in my mind, and hopefully in the mind of intelligent investors, you know, they're slowly but surely losing their credibility. I mean, they had to admit we blew it on transitory, you know, and so, you know, they're playing tough guy right now, but you watch, it won't take much for them to say, well, you know, they've always said we're data dependent. So they're trying to get some data that favors their story. And they probably will. They may not, but they probably will. And then they will use that to pivot. The other possibility of a pivot is just financial markets really become discontinuous. And we're close to that. You know, there's a lot of, I mean, you're seeing these signs, right? You know, Italy's bond yields blow out. They have an emergency ECB meeting. Those don't happen every day, right? You know, the Japanese, the JGB bonds, they're pegged at 0.25. They've got yield curve control going on. They, you know, overnight they blow up and they trade through that all the time to 0.45. And the JGB has to purchase record amounts of their bonds. You know, I mean, the yen is in a pretty serious downtrend. You know, so Japan is going to see very serious inflation. So, you know, you see the CDS spreads are going up, the high yield spreads are going up. I mean, it's, you know, you're seeing cracks in the dam that would indicate that something is going to break. Mm-hmm. And we know the third Fed mandate is, you know, not allowing the system to break. And so, you know, my belief is the system will break. And I can't tell, it could happen tomorrow, it could happen in October. And the reason I haven't moved out of the, you know, the super volatile, risky assets that I'm in, like Bitcoin and gold miners, is that it could happen so fast and these things are illiquid enough that, you know, I don't, and when it does happen, it's going to move really quick. And so you could miss the first 20 to 40% in a week. So as a result of that, I just take a position, it's not levered, that I believe is correct, you know, and then I, you know, bend over and say, thank you, sir, can I have another? I mean, as they whack the living shit out of my portfolio. Mm-hmm. So, you know, everybody has to play it their own way. I mean, I've always said, you know, don't use leverage. That's what gets you carried out. And know what you own and know why you own it, right? Because these things will work, you know, but we've got to wait until the tide goes in the other direction. Mm-hmm. So sorry, that was very long-winded. I don't know if I addressed your dollar strength question, but we can go there if you want.
Yeah, I mean, there's a million places to go within what you said, but, you know, do you think that the Fed could just take a break on increasing rates instead of actually reversing course and restarting QE?
Well, that's right. I think there are lots of variations on taper, right? Mm-hmm. And, on going in the other direction. You know, they can jawbone it. I mean, to date, we noticed that they did some pretty aggressive things, and I think they didn't get the reaction they wanted, so they got even more aggressive. And that's why they had to channel Volcker, because it's like, come on, you guys, we told you we're going to tighten this shit. You know, the market keeps going up. You know, mm-hmm. Oil keeps going up. I mean, I think you know. So yeah. I mean, they can and probably will, you know, do a little, you know, head fake at some point. And they could soften it up. But then if the market goes, I mean, look, they are trying. It's funny. It's a screwed up situation, right? I mean, here's the whole investment world watching what a bunch of people say to try and reflexively to try and determine what the hell the market's going to do. It's nuts. you know, and if it doesn't do what they want it to do, they usually have other guys come out and say something different so that they get the reaction they want. I mean, they need the oil price to cool off. They really badly need it. They need inflation to cool off politically. And, you know, once they get that, then sure, they could do a semi taper, you know, where they or, you know, they could slow it down or indicate they could coup dovishly, I guess, is the right description. Mm-hmm. You know, who knows exactly what they're going to do and how they're going to do it. I think that the bottom line, though, is that the way the system is constructed, the continuing with the hawkish pace that they've got right now will literally drive the stock market to zero. I mean, it will literally destroy the stock market and the economy. And there's some who say, there's some very conspiracy-oriented people say, well, that's what they want to do. Mm-hmm. They want to do that so that they can give everybody UBI and bring in CBDCs. I mean, and that's possible. I mean, I'm not... You know, I don't know what their motivations are exactly. It's very difficult to tell. I don't think they want to go there. I think what they want to do is cool things off enough that they feel like they've got the inflation thing somewhat under control, and then they want to prevent a complete and utter meltdown. I mean, at some point in time, if the stock market goes down another 30%, people are going to be freaked out. I mean, people are already kind of freaked out in the circles I run in right now. I mean, nobody's ever seen this before, mm-hmm. right? I mean, you never had a case where stocks didn't work and bonds didn't work and inflation was raging. I mean, it's like, whoa, what's this all about? So, you know, my sense is that they're going to have to taper sometime this fall. That's my belief. Mm-hmm. And that when they do, our stuff is just going to go bananas, because they're going to lose credibility. I mean, the fact of the matter is, without cheap money, without continued expansion of the credit and the monetary base, the whole house of cards collapses. And they don't want that. I mean, I think if I look at what their goals are, I think their goal is to continually try and kick the can and stay in power. You know, and if that involves jerking us back and forth, you know, like they have, well, you know, tough shit. I mean, their view is, you know, tough shit. Mm-hmm. You know, you guys can handle it, which is frankly just evil and sick. I mean, that, you know, what they're putting us through. I mean, they, you know, by keeping money too easy for too long, they created all kinds of stupid bubbles and all kinds of misallocation of capital. And now by clamping down on it, you know, they're going to send us in the other direction. And, you know, a lot of innocent people are going to get hurt in that direction as well. So it's like, you know, the correct answer here is to go to a neutral reserve currency and to end the Fed. But of course, you know, they're not going to vote for that because they enjoy having the power. Mm-hmm. So
Larry, could we talk a little bit more about, in some ways we're seeing a deflationary impulse in the equities and let's say the commodity space, you know, oil, gold, all of these different commodities are coming down. Equities are really coming down. And yet you see the headline consumer price inflation or CPI still high. So how can we have both inflation and deflation at the same time? And is this just kind of part and parcel of this cycle?
Yeah, I've said this for a while. I mean, I think we're going to have inflation and all the stuff you need and deflation and all the stuff you own. And the other part, Tom, I know you and I have talked about in the past is, you know, there's a lag, right? I mean, things, you know, things don't happen instantly, but they do happen. And so, you know, my sense is we might have at 8.6, we might have reached the peak of inflation in this cycle. I don't know. I mean, I really don't know. The prints could go higher. But it's possible we've reached the peak. And, and so, you know, we'll start to see some decrease. I mean, are we going back to 2%? No. I mean, the old world is gone, right? I mean, that's just gone. We live in an inflationary environment now. I think most people would accept that. You know, if you look at the 1970s, you know, what you saw was these various waves of inflation. You know, it would run hard and then it would back off, and it would run hard and it would back off. And so I think it's entirely possible that we are going to back off for a little bit. You know, I mean, look. Certainly, I think we probably reached peak house inflation. In my quarterly report, My quarterly report showed that we had, or it shows a housing price chart where, you know, U.S. housing prices almost just went straight up. And I think we probably reached the peak there, right? I mean, I'm not hearing about bidding wars. I'm not hearing about, you know, jumping over the last round, et cetera, that kind of stuff. And that's partly driven by the fact that, you know, the cost of buying a house now just went up. I mean, 30-year mortgage rates were 3% a couple of years ago, and they're now close, approaching 6%. So it's, you know, you're going to get a lot of mixed signals in this kind of an environment. It's going to be very, very choppy. But I would contend that the people who control the money supply, at the end of the day, their default condition has to be to debase the currency, because, you know, Grohman had some great numbers on this. I mean, when countries get to this level of indebtedness, 120% debt to GDP, and they run this size of deficits, there are very, very few cases. There are almost zero cases where they didn't get out of this through either a complete and total debt collapse, which I don't think they'll allow to happen, or very high inflation, in some cases, hyperinflation. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, could there be a debt collapse? Well, yeah, there could be. But, my sense is they realize that that's a worse choice than very high inflation. And so what they're going to try for is some kind of managed inflation. And, you know, what else can they do, right? It's the path out of this, in my opinion, will be very high inflation for a bunch of years to bring down the debt to GDP ratio. That'll be the end point.
Mm-hmm. And Larry, you post, you know, on a somewhat regular basis on your Twitter account called Hyperinflation Chart of the Day. So how do you define hyperinflation?
Well, yeah, I'm being hyperbolic there. Okay. Mm-hmm. The fact of the matter is, hyperinflation is inflation of 50% a month, and we haven't seen that anywhere. We're not even close to hyperinflation yet. But one thing is true, that high inflation always precedes hyperinflation. And we have seen several instances of certain things that have kind of had hyperinflation-like characteristics. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, electricity costs in Germany, or natural gas, or fertilizer costs. I mean, there are a number of things in the world that have, quote unquote, hyperinflated over a 1 month type of time frame. And that's, you know, that's somewhat of a problem, right? And like I said, high inflation leads to hyperinflation.
Larry, you mentioned earlier that this was a big bubble in search of a pin. And as soon as Powell started raising rates and cutting the balance sheet, it seems like really gold and silver miners got hit at that time too. And considering that many of us are in that space, you know, would it have been a good idea to just start liquidating those positions when the Fed started taking this hawkish stance, just based on history, really?
Yeah, it would have been. And I'm a little angry at myself for kind of blowing that call. I mean, I didn't have, you know, Jerome Powell, you know, tries to emulate Paul Volcker on my bingo card. I mean, it wasn't one of my, you know, I thought they were smarter than they are. I thought they were, they would realize that going full hard, you know, deflationary, you know, inflation control a la Volcker was a very dangerous thing to do, and they wouldn't do it. And they would definitely lean in that direction, but they would leave themselves an out, and they would just try to bring inflation off the boil, not totally kill it like mm-hmm. they're trying to do right now. And so yes, in retrospect, it would have been a good move. Obviously, I mean, you look at how much the stuff has been down in the last two quarters. You know, it's been a pretty hard hit. But again, many of the things I'm in are small and illiquid. So it's not like I can, you know, in fact, I almost feel like I'm running a private venture capital portfolio mm-hmm. because I look at a market price and the market's not very deep. And in fact, I mean, and that actually works both ways. I mean, it works like I probably couldn't have gotten out of some of these things up at the top. In turn, right now, you know, these prices are whacked down pretty hard, but I've gone in and tried to buy some of these things, and there's not a lot of supply either. Mm-hmm. And so I start buying something that's down big, and it's not like I can fill my bucket with that low cost stock. There's nobody there selling it to me. It's just there because there's kind of, you know, it's a dull market. It's going down. There's no bid, you know, the bid's low. Mm-hmm. The minute I start to try and buy it, the bid moves up. So, mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of like, you know, if you're playing in this space, it's venture capital, like you've got to be willing to hold on to stuff, you know, through the waves, through the ups and downs. It makes it tricky. I mean, now don't get me wrong. That's not as much true with the bigger names, but the bigger names haven't moved as much. And I mean, there is plenty of liquidity in the majors, mm-hmm. but in the juniors, the stuff I'm in, a lot of the stuff I'm in, you know, there's less liquidity. It's not as easy to move in and out of it. And the torque on some of these things is really substantial. I mean, you know, I've got things that should be up 5x, you know, on the next upswing. So, if you want to play for that kind of upside and, you know, you've got to be willing to accept a 30% drawdown, you know, or a 40% drawdown, you know, sometimes more. Mm-hmm.
But and like you say, if this turns quickly, you want to be able to have those positions to be able to, you know, recapitalize on that.
That's the thing. That's what makes it so difficult. I mean, you can't, so it'll turn and people say, give me that stock, and there won't be any stock to be had. And that's why they'll, you know, just as quickly as much as they've been beat up, they'll be up a lot. I mean, mm-hmm. so it's a difficult space in that regard. I mean, people have to look at the longer term view and recognize, you know, that with extreme optionality, you know, there also comes substantial downside, you know, when the tide is going in the wrong direction. And the way there are a lot of ways to deal with that, but one way is, you know, just size your positions. I mean, you know, there are stocks that are very risky that have 5x upside and also 50% drawdown potential. Okay, fine. And you want to play with that. You want to think, all right, when it goes well, I want to get that 5x upside, but gee, going down 50% kind of hurts. Doesn't feel real great. What do you do? All right, I'll take a 1% weighting. You know, if I've got 1% of my portfolio in a stock that can go down 50% and can go up 5x, you know, irrespective of what happens to it. I mean, you know, that's a bet I'm making. I'll look at a bunch of those. You know, and they're all correlated, obviously, to which way the money trends are running. But, you know, then I've diversified so that if one of them becomes an Alexco or an Arcana, you know, I'm not getting wiped out. It was a 1% position and it turned into a piece of shit. You know, okay, fine. You know, in turn, I've got this other thing that's, you know, that's a snow line or a lion one or whatever it might be that's got a lot of upside when it turns and goes the other way. So, you know, it's, you got to size your positions according to the risk that you see in the underlying security. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, something else that we kind of touched on was that Germany has recently posted its first trade deficit in many years due to really lack of gas and energy to manufacture the goods that they typically do. So do you see this as maybe start of pain that could ultimately change public attitude towards some of these, you know, overly progressive ESG policies that have destroyed the world's energy supplies and supply chains? I mean,
boy, what, you know, what a shit show ESG has been, right? I mean, these people, I mean, I know, you know, Trudeau, all these guys are just, they just weren't thinking this through. In fact, it was fascinating. I read this morning an article that said that Germany had moved to reclassify nuclear and gas as ESG friendly. Which I thought was kind of interesting. I mean, you know, you shut down your nuclear facilities, you turn off your coal plants, you rely, you know, 100% on Russia, you know, and then you decide, you know, your biggest ally, the U.S., decides to sanction Russia. And guess what? You know, you got a problem, right? I mean, as Putin and these guys have said, you know, our commodities, your problem. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, and Biden's done it too. I mean, you know, with you stop offshore drilling, you stop exploration, you kill the Keystone Pipeline. That wasn't Biden, but you know what I'm saying. I mean, you rail at the energy companies, you rail at the oil companies. You know, you talk about windfall profit taxes. Well, you know, you want to talk about how to incentivize companies not to produce more of what you need. You know, it's like these governments are like the poster child for stupid policies, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we all pay more for energy because they're not letting the free market do its thing. Yeah, no, ESG was and always has been just stupid wokeism, in my view. Mm-hmm. You know, we need nuclear power. I mean, not to say we don't need alternatives. Sure, we need alternatives. We need tons of them. But we also need nuclear power. We also need, you know, gas. We need more pipelines. We need to trade with one another. I mean,
maybe a more sober look at generating and producing this power rather than an emotional view or a political view on it.
Exactly. Exactly. And I mean, the one that really frustrates me is nuclear, because it is a solution to the problems, and yet some stupid old plants which went south have terrified the whole world into not pursuing, you know, one of the decent alternatives. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's been costly for all of us, in my view. I mean, we are all paying the price for a lack of energy investment in energy infrastructure. Mm-hmm. In the last 20 years. And that's sad. And it's, I wish we had politicians who were more forward thinking.
The incentives are not aligned for that though, Larry.
No, they're really not. They're really not. Let's not go there. I try to avoid the whole political sphere, with the exception of the Federal Reserve and how they're screwing things up. I mean, there's enough to talk about right there. I mean, without talking about all the other guys who are, mm-hmm. you know, beyond dumb. So,
and, you know, interestingly, if we think about incentives, I recently did a podcast about nuclear energy with Mark Nelson, and he was saying that there was actually a lot of the oil and gas industry railed against nuclear and provided a lot of misinformation to the public, which was really interesting, considering that really the incentives are aligned for them, you know, to hate on nuclear. And that has contributed to the situation that we now find ourselves in, right?
Yeah, no, that's not surprising. I'll just tell a funny anecdote. I think you'll enjoy, and your listeners will enjoy as well. I learned something new in a trip recently I took. I don't know if you knew this, but Britain, Great Britain, was really a leader in developing automobile technology. In the 1860s, they had horseless carriages. They had, you know, cars, more or less, internal combustion engines on cars. And they were preparing to kind of use them widely. And the train lobby in Britain got very involved in this and got them classified as road locomotives. And if you were going to operate, and said they were extremely dangerous. And the train lobby obviously didn't want to see people driving cars and not taking trains. Mm-hmm. And so they passed a series of laws whereby if you were going to drive a car in Britain, you needed to hire an engineer, a train engineer, and have them sit in the front seat to direct you. And you needed to have a guy walking in front of you with a red flag talking about how this very dangerous road locomotive was coming down the road, so that anyone with a horse or walking would be aware of the danger of this moving vehicle. Well, as you might imagine, those laws really kind of killed the Brits should have had the automobile industry. They should have locked it up. It's 1865. I mean, Henry Ford didn't get the Model T going until the early 1900s. So I mean, almost 30 years before, I mean, the Swiss and Benz and Mercedes in Germany were all building automobiles as well in the late 1880s, 1890s. But the point is the Brits had the technology to be a leader in the automobile industry, and the railroad lobby just killed it. It just totally killed it. And it reminds me very much of what you're saying about the oil and gas people getting involved in government and, you know, putting the kibosh on, you know, the decent alternatives. I mean, the other alternative, and I don't know that the oil and gas people have fought it, but it's really a great alternative. I don't know how many people have studied geothermal, but if you look at how Iceland runs themselves, I mean, geothermal is a really great source of power. And the fact that we haven't been investing more heavily in it, it's just absolutely nuts. I mean, it's, you know, the world could power itself much more heavily on geothermal. And I think if you look at the actual energy return for capital invested, it depends on where you locate it, but it might be more economic than wind and solar. Mm-hmm. I'm not 100% sure of that, but I had one guy tell me that. So
I think it depends on how deep you have to go, all of that. But yeah,
exactly. I mean, there are a lot of issues involved, but the point, I mean, if your general point, governments will do everything they can to F things up. Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the sad point, you know, of the system that we live in. And, you know, to me, the tip of the spear on that is money. You know, I mean, how the hell, if you're a businessman, how the hell are you supposed to run a business when you don't know if, you know, we've got massive inflation and things are growing incredibly and you should be building more capacity because there's a ton of demand, or we've got massive deflation and, you know, we've got to pay back our debts and nobody has any dollars and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, part of the reason, part of what drove me into the sound money fight is the story of my grandfather. My grandfather was a small businessman in Ann Arbor, Michigan in the 1920s. And he owned a retail furniture store. It was a house that he'd turned into a store. And his father's father had been a furniture manufacturer and immigrated to Ann Arbor and started selling furniture to everyone who was going to the University of Michigan, because the University of Michigan was growing like a weed. And the roaring 20s came along. And sure enough, there was a lot of demand for furniture and a lot of demand for housing, a lot of demand for everything. It was the roaring 20s, you know, free money, stock market's cooking. My grandfather said, he looked at those signals. He said, oh, shit, I don't have enough capacity here. I got to double the size of my store. And he said, well, I don't have the money to do that. So he went out and he borrowed, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, the Fed had told him that, you know, everything was going great. And he borrowed and doubled the size of his store right in 1928. He got that done. Okay. And he had a big load of debt to pay for that capacity expansion, right? Bubble collapsed. Depression occurred. You know, he had a bunch of employees. He was selling more furniture than he could, you know, right? I mean, he'd gotten all these signals. He was a businessman. He'd gotten signals. He said, this is what I'm supposed to do. Mm-hmm. I need more capacity. And then everything collapsed and depression arrives. And he's down to, he and his wife are the only two employees. He's delivering all the furniture himself. You know, he's basically struggling every week, begging the banker not to foreclose on him, right? And my grandmother, when she was dying in the 60s, you know, she kept saying in her death tremors, you know, they don't have any debt. They don't have any debt. I mean, the whole thing was a totally scarring experience mm-hmm. for the two of them. I mean, they just hung on by their fingernails from 1930 to 1946. And they almost lost the business. Thankfully, they didn't. It recovered. They did fine. But the point is, he was just an average businessman trying to run his life. And a bunch of, you know, bozos at the Federal Reserve created a bubble and then burst the bubble. And, you know, it created enormous pain. And I mean, and this is what these people don't see. I mean, you know, look at 2008. I mean, my sister lost her house. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, these people don't see the consequences of their actions through irresponsible monetary policy. They create bubbles, which then naturally lead to busts. And the rest of us are out here just trying to live our lives, do honest, hard work, support our families, you know, and do things that economically make sense. And yet, how can you make choices about what economically makes sense when the underlying thing you're dealing with, money, is grossly manipulated by the Federal Reserve, which can fart around with these interest rates? I mean, the price of money, I've said this many, many times, the price of money should be set in the market. It should be a price, it should be an interest rate which balances returns for savers with needs for good projects. Mm-hmm. If the money is sound, that's what happens, and society gets richer. Everybody does what's in their best interest, which in turn becomes in society's best interest, because we make correct economic decisions based on correct and sound economic inputs. And what's going on here is we've got these ridiculous inputs that are moving around like dials on an airplane, you know, screen. And it's like, you know, what the hell am I supposed to do with that? You know, oil's out of, I mean, recently Goldman Sachs came out and said, oil might go to 340. Mm-hmm. Holy shit. If oil goes to 340, the world as we know it is over. You know, I mean, you know, and in turn, given what the Fed's now doing, oil may go back down to 50. Mm-hmm. So imagine you're in the oil business. What are you supposed to be doing? Biden's yelling at you that he's going to tax the shit out of you. You know, prices have gone up a lot, but you've seen this movie before. You know that when the deflation comes, oil could very easily go down a lot. Hell, in 2020, oil was selling at negative prices. Mm-hmm. I mean, how the hell are you supposed to make business decisions based on prices which are completely, completely fake? I mean, the price, there's no price in the world right now which you can rely on. You know, and so this, Tom, is the underlying problem. Mm-hmm. And until we solve this problem, you know, we are all going to experience, you know, these continued waves of inflation, deflation, and economic pain. And we've got to fight to fix the problem, which is we've got to go to the source of the problem, which is these monetary mandarins who are screwing around with the system. Mm-hmm. We got to get rid of them. And we got to say, look, you know, we're going to, I mean, people say, well, you're all you do is complain about the monetary system. You know, what are you going to do to fix it? It's simple. I know what I do to fix it. Very, very simple. We do what Roosevelt did. We do a reval. We would say, okay, X number of old dollars equals Y number of new dollars. The Y number of new dollars is equal to, you know, this much gold or this much Bitcoin or this much oil or this much of a basket of the three. And you can exchange at any point in time. You can go to the monetary authority and you can exchange your dollars for these things. And as a result of that, you know, those are all neutral reserve currency. Oil is a neutral reserve currency. Gold is a neutral reserve currency. Bitcoin is a neutral reserve currency. And that's what we need. And if we had money tied to energy, money tied to a neutral reserve currency, the money would be sound. And then if we had sound money, the natural thing that would flow out of that is the interest rates would be correct. If you had capital, you would be able to go and say, does this project make sense? And what's the return on it? What, you know, am I going to get a return that justifies the interest rate cost of borrowing to pursue this project? And good projects would be pursued, and cryptocurrencies and NFTs would not be pursued, right? I mean, it'd be really simple, right? And everything would settle down, and people would do what's economically sensible. Mm-hmm. You know, this is not that hard, folks. It's just not that hard. It's completely doable. What people can't see is that we're so far away from that that most people have completely lost any sense of thinking about how to get back to that. Mm-hmm. But that's what we got to do. We've got to get back to that. If we want to have a functioning, healthy society for our kids and grandkids, and that's why I'm in this game right now, that's what we got to do. And the sooner the better.
Yeah. That idea that, you know, the price of money can in turn determine behavior is really interesting. And I think it's really important to think of it that way. Number one. Number two, when we don't have a free market as well, that distorts things on the other side of that coin. If we had sound money, but not having a free market that can function the way it needs to without lobbyists or, you know, whatever example you want to use, it's kind of two sides of the same coin, right?
That's exactly right. No, it's exactly right. It's two sides of the same coin, and it's, you know, it's driven by a broken political system. We let, you know, the Constitution of the United States said only silver and gold could be money. And we're so far away from that as to be, you know, it's ridiculous how far away from that we are. Mm-hmm. And we got to get back to a neutral reserve currency. I mean, it's just, it's life or death. It really is life or death for all of us. Mm-hmm. We've got to get back to a neutral reserve currency. And, you know, so my, you know, my efforts in both in my investing life and outside of my investing life are to advocate for that. I mean, the most important thing the most important role I see myself as having is being a sound money advocate. If we do not get back to sound money, we are doomed. Mm-hmm. We're absolutely doomed. The good news is, you know, just to be on a brighter note, the good news is I actually think we will get back to sound money. I don't think there's any doubt we're going to get there. The time scale, I wish it were a little faster, right? You know, it's not like we all have infinite, you know, livelihoods. As Kane said, in the long run, we're all dead. Mm-hmm. But the long run is coming, and we will get back there because, you know, it's quite obvious how broken the current system is.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's why we're in this space. We're trying to position ourselves and in turn educate.
Well, that's
help, exactly help right. Educate, you know, the general public, our listeners, about those ideas, right?
That's exactly right. I mean, and I think that's really the best that all of us can do is to spread the word, to try and educate as many people as possible to hold their savings in things that cannot be debased. Mm-hmm. You know, and you know, we all know what those are.
Mm-hmm. Well, Larry, I think that's a good place to wrap up today's conversation. Did you have anything else that you wanted to
add? I really don't, Tom. I think we hit the high points. I'm happy to come back anytime. And, you know, I encourage people to follow me on Twitter. I try and put a lot of information on there about what's going on and what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm. You are a great follow on Twitter @LawrenceLepard. And of course, your quarterly letters are excellent as well. And you're almost ready to release the newest one?
Yeah, I was drafting it as we came on, as we spoke, before we spoke. Yeah, Q2 will be out soon. And they're historical, right? And so you can, if you want to get some context, you can go to the website, ema2.com, and we have them all listed for years going back there. So you can, they're on PDF form, it's all free. Also at that site, you can sign up so that we will send them to you. We won't spam you. You can just enter your email address. There's a little place there to do that. You'll be on the mailing list to receive them. So yeah, the Q2 one, what is it now? The sixth. The Q2 should be out in another 4 or 5 days.
Excellent. Look forward to getting through it.
Okay. Thanks, Tom. Thank you for your time and always enjoy talking with you. You clearly get it. And we're all in the same fight together. I would just say to Gold Bull, you know, everyone who's in Sound Money, just be strong. We're going to be fine. I've seen this plenty of times before. This is nothing. You should have been around in 2015.
Well, it's good to have some context.
Or 2013.
Yeah.
We're going to be just fine. We're in the right place. It's, just sit back and things will come our way.
Sit back and repaint your dinghy from the barnacle removal.
Yeah, right? Exactly. That's what I was doing the other day. Yeah. Do the maintenance around your boats.
Yeah. All right, Larry. Really appreciate your time. Take care.
Likewise. Bye-bye.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.